Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have as our guest today, Kirk Cooper, who is the Chief Staff Attorney with the 8th Court of Appeals in El Paso. Welcome to the show, Kirk.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
We're super happy to have you on the show. We haven't had enough court staff as our guests yet, and that's a trend that we're looking to change. And so we were very fortunate to have had Kirk reach out to us and talk to us about coming on the show. And we're pleased to have him because I think he's got some interesting things to say. And I look forward to hearing those things today. So Kirk, tell the audience a little about yourself, where you come from and your background and how you became a lawyer.
Sure. So I was born and raised in the great city of El Paso, where I currently reside. My story is kind of, I guess, a standard borderland desert story. My dad is white. My mom is Mexican-American. I grew up in sort of a mixed culture household, great food, got used to living in 100 plus degree heat all my life. But being a lawyer was never really something that was on my radar. Originally, I had wanted to be a professional musician. So I went to the University of North Texas. They told me they had one of the best music schools in the country. So I was like, well, I want to be one of the best musicians in the country. So I auditioned, got in. My first semester of college, I was a jazz studies major, which is a real thing. People don't believe that. It's a real thing. But after about a semester in the music school, I just decided that it wasn't really for me. So I switched out for multiple reasons, many of which are encapsulated by the movie Whiplash. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's like Miles Teller, who's the drummer, and there's like a crazy band director played by J.K. Simmons, who may be psychotic. I'm not saying that was my experience. I'm saying it just resonated a little too close to home. So I switched out of music school, went into journalism school because I like to write, worked for the school paper, really enjoyed that. Ended up minoring in journalism, majoring in international studies with a focus on the Middle East. During college, I had done a study abroad in Tunisia as part of a State Department program to learn Arabic. Fell in love with the language, fell in love with the country. So when I graduated from college, I thought that I was either going to do something in journalism or that I was going to do something kind of related to national security, maybe go to the FBI Academy, but I was still a little young for the academy. And I graduated in 2009. And I don't know if you all remember, but the economy in 2009 was horse manure, let's say. So I moved back to El Paso, tried to find a job, had a lead on an on-air reporter position with a local TV station. But before I could go in for the interview, some company in the corporate chain went bankrupt and they're like, sorry, we don't have this position open anymore. So as I was looking for work, I started doing volunteer work with an organization called the Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center, which is a local nonprofit that still does pro bono legal work for immigrants and refugees from all around the world who pass through Juarez into El Paso. And so that was sort of where I kind of started doing some legal work. One of the attorneys taught me how to use LexisNexis, and it sort of everything kind of came together and clicked. I was able to have that little international facet of being able to talk to clients from around the world. I was able to use my writing skills to help draft briefs and even parts of appeals to the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is the administrative body overseeing the immigration courts. And I got to do research and I like to learn. And it was like the perfect opportunity to learn something new every day. So I thought to myself, well, maybe law is where I belong, you know, and I never would have thought it would be where I belong. But I ended up applying, went to the George Washington University for law school. And then I came back to El Paso and I got a job with the 8th Court of Appeals, and I've been there ever since.
We've had some guests on to talk about non-traditional paths to appellate practice. I love your story. It fits right into that sort of alternative way of getting into the practice area and becoming interested in it. That's really neat.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I said, I would have never thought that I would become an attorney, but it's been a great fit. And appellate law, especially for someone who likes to write and someone who's sort of a nerd and someone who can spend all day in front of a computer just reading and digesting a lot of information. It's great. Like I said, you get to learn something new every day. And I can tell you that working at the court, I've definitely learned something new every day.
We completely understand sitting in a computer, reading and digesting all day. That is where we spend our lives as well. So you started out as a staff attorney, like with the chambers?
Yes. So when I first started, originally it was kind of just going to be a interim internship while I was waiting for my bar results. There were two positions open, but they were looking for someone with more experience. But eventually they said, okay, well, why not hire him on? And so it was a question of whether I was going to go with Chief Justice Ann McClure or Justice Yvonne Rodriguez. Justice Rodriguez ended up calling dibs. So I ended up working for her. I started off as her law clerk. And then the way that it works with us is we don't really do like with the federal courts where there's a law clerk that works for a year or two. It's more, you start as a clerk and then you can kind of get promoted. We're more of a permanent staff sort of model. So I started off as her law clerk, was promoted up through staff attorney and her senior staff attorney. And then that was for about a period of 6 years. And then a couple of years ago, Chief Justice McClure retired. Her chief staff attorney had retired. And so at that point, I was promoted to chief staff attorney.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge. So are you, as chief staff attorney, do you work kind of for the court as a whole, or are you assigned to particular chambers?
Yeah, so I sort of work for the court as a whole. I answer the chief justice, but basically it's sort of a blended role. Different courts do it different ways. I don't think I'm giving away any state secrets by saying this, but you know, some courts, the chief staff attorney will sort of be like the head of the attorneys and there'll be like a central pool. Other courts have them serving kind of a general counsel role where they'll counsel the justices about administrative procedure, HR things, things like that. Some of them have their chief staff attorneys doing mandamuses or emergency proceedings. So it really kind of depends on the court. At my court, I do a little bit of everything. I do provide advice to all the justices. I handle the mandamus and emergency docket. I handle parental rights terminations, basically anything that's kind of faster moving. Either I'll handle it directly or I'll be the first person to touch that. I'm sort of the legal advisor to the clerk's office. So if there's a question about, oh, is this document compliant or whatever, that'll come to me and I get to look it up in the rules and say, no, it's not PDF searchable. Tell them to make a PDF searchable. And then there's that fun back and forth with that. So I do advise the clerk's office. I advise the justices. I have my own caseload. Now, Chief Justice Rodriguez has hired some extra help. So we have a central staff to help us clear our backlog. I'm supervising them. So I'm pretty busy. I've got a lot on my plate.
Like it. And I would imagine, especially with the original proceedings and family termination and stuff, the things that have to have a quick turnaround, you have your plate and then suddenly things start getting dropped in, particularly on Fridays at 4 p.m.
I am very familiar with the Friday at 4 p.m. syndrome. I dread Fridays now because I'm like, all right, I don't want to say what fresh hell will this bring, but it's like, please don't file something at 4:55. Don't ruin my weekend. But I mean, if you have to, obviously do it. But there's always an anxiety spike around that time.
Well, the experienced appellate lawyers typically don't do that. And they certainly know that if they need to do something even approximating that, that they need to be calling the clerk and letting the court know. And if you're listening and you don't know to do that, I'll just speak on Kirk's behalf here and say, please let the court know if you're going to drop an emergency on them late in the afternoon on a Friday. Don't do it, preferably, but it's best to communicate.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, We are more than willing to stay late, but for us, it's more of we need the communication to be able to plan logistically, because it's like, okay, are you talking about you're going to file something at 5:15 and we need to ask our deputy clerks to stay a little late? Are you going to stay file something at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock? Because we've had situations where there was one situation where a building was going to be demolished. And so they said they needed an emergency order and that ended up having to be filed 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. And so if there's something like that, which that's a very unusual situation, but we had a judge available, we had someone available to help process it through TAIN. So really it's just communicate to us. And the other thing is that if you're going to file something that's an emergency motion, you know, sometimes we'll get calls where it'll be around, like, let's say 3 o'clock, and the clerk's office will let me know, oh, someone says they're going to file an emergency motion. And it'll be like, okay, well, are they asking for an extension? And they'll say, no, they're just going to file it. And I'm like, all right, well, let's keep an eye out. And then 5 o'clock will roll around and we haven't heard anything. So I'll have them reach out and say, okay, just call to make sure. And then the attorney will be like, oh, well, actually, no, we're going to file it, but we're going to file it tomorrow. And so it's like, okay, well, first of all, if you're going to file it tomorrow, how much of an emergency is it really? Because for me, emergency is you're going to file it either it needs a quick turnaround or it's going to be filed outside of regular business hours. So if you're calling and saying you're going to file an emergency motion and then it turns out that it can actually wait till tomorrow, like I said, let us know, because it's really just a matter of logistics. We'll look at it, but we just need to know.
I would imagine that a lot of practitioners and a lot of court staff have very different definitions of what constitutes an emergency.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely that. I mean, sometimes we'll get people who, again, we're talking about the Friday at 4:50 situation where somebody has forgotten that there's a hearing on Monday and all of a sudden it's an emergency and we need to stop it. And there may be a legitimate basis for doing that, but generally things that are calendar issues or things like that aren't necessarily emergencies in the way that it's like, you know, like I said, we've had a situation where buildings were going to be turned down and we needed to issue, you know, emergency orders to prevent that from happening. Or we've had depositions where there's a privilege issue and we're running up against a statute of limitations and there's a question of whether someone needs to answer that question by 5 or otherwise everything expires and we'll blow a statute of limitations and someone loses a claim. So to me, those are a little bit more emergency. But like I said, if you call it an emergency, we'll look at it. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be an emergency. Doesn't necessarily mean we're going to rule on it. It's a flexible standard. But generally speaking, forgetting about a hearing on Monday is probably not as much of an emergency as the other things that I talked about.
Yeah, I think it's probably hard to come up with just like a real litmus test for what is an emergency. But I think a building getting knocked down is a good thing to consider. You're thinking about things that really can't be undone. Privilege, like you point out, destruction of property, the things that really, once the bell's been rung, you can't unring it. I would encourage lawyers to think long and hard before filing something as an emergency. It really needs to be your client is facing the loss of some right that really just can't be remedied. Maybe that's the litmus test. I hadn't thought about it, but maybe.
Right.
We talked about this before we started recording, but the good news for those of us in a lot of part of the state is you have an extra hour with the 8th court. So you can actually go till 5:55 Central Time before you file your emergency motion on them right before the end of the day, because y'all are in a different time zone.
That's true. But that can cut both ways. I remember there was one time where we did have a mandamus filed by an attorney who was from outside the time zone. I don't remember if it was Houston, Austin, or Dallas. So I won't speculate as to which city to blame for this, but they did inform us, you know, we're filing this mandamus. And along with the mandamus, we're requesting emergency relief. And to be honest, I don't even remember what the relief they were requesting was, but they had specifically said, we need a ruling by 5 or 5:30 or something along those lines. And in the context, it was something that had made sense. So I told the clerk's office, don't worry, I'm going to run this by the judges to see what they think. We'll get them a decision, but I need to do a workup. This was filed maybe around, I want to say, noon. I was like, I'm going to get a workup. I'm going to get a grasp on this, run it by them, let them get a grasp on this. We'll get a decision. And so I want to say maybe around 2:30 or 3, we start getting a lot of really antsy calls, very sharp tone to the clerks of like, they're upset because they still haven't gotten a decision. And I'm like, well, it's only 3 o'clock. We're working on it. And we already promised them that we'll get them something by 5. And then of course at 3:30, we get a call saying If the court doesn't issue anything by 5, we're prepared to take this to the Texas Supreme Court. We'll bypass you because we need a decision now, and da 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 da. And the clerks were like, well, they're getting kind of snippy with us and kind of rude. And so at this point, I'm like, well, one, the court acts on its own timeline. We don't act on your timeline, but we've also told you we're going to get it to you by 5. I don't know what the deal is. And then at 3:45, we get notice that a mandamus had been filed against us in the Texas Supreme Court because we hadn't ruled yet. And then finally I figured out and I was like, oh, this is a time zone issue because in Austin or Dallas or Houston, it's already 4:45, but here it's 3:45. So it's one of those kind of logistical things that you don't really think about, but if you need something by 5 Central, tell us by 5 Central, or otherwise it's going to be 5 Mountain. So like I said, it can be an advantage if you need the extra hour, but otherwise it can present a problem.
I'm thinking about those midnight e-filings, which I thankfully am doing fewer of these days, but in Central Time, if I went to file something at say 11:45 PM, I mean, I guess technically I'd get that extra hour. I don't want to influence anyone to push it that close.
No. But I mean, the rule says it's midnight wherever the court is sitting. So that's exactly right. I mean, if it's like 12:01 Central and you're like, oh my God, I forgot to submit it, it's still 11:01 El Paso time. So don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure it would still be timely because it's based on wherever the court is sitting. So you get that extra hour.
That's right. Let's not encourage anyone to.
No, absolutely not. Get it in on time. You know, I've had situations too where someone will file something at like 12:02 and it'll be that they clicked it and thought it went through, but it didn't actually get in until 12:02. And the next morning I'll have a motion for extension of time on my desk. And I'm like, what is it talking about? And it's like asking for a 2-minute extension of time to make it timely because when they clicked on the electronic submission, it was midnight, but the time it actually made it through all the pipes, it was 12:02 and it was technically late. And I'm like, really? But then I'm like, okay, well, we got to handle this because just a dot I's and cross T's. But I mean, these are the things that can blow up in your face.
The little details you don't think about necessarily.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Well, you mentioned Chief Justice McClure, and she's now departed from the court, and Chief Justice Rodriguez, former justice, is now the chief. It's a 3-judge court, and you've got a couple of relatively new faces. One, Justice Alley, who just joined the court this year, and Justice Palafox, who's been there for a few years now. So how's that been? I mean, you've been around the court longer than two of the current sitting justices. How's that been going through the transition?
Well, I will say just off the bat, Justice Alley, actually, he was previously the Chief Justice. Now he's Associate Justice. But even though he's been a justice maybe for about a couple of years, he was actually Chief Justice McClure's staff attorney for a few years before then. So the good thing was that he already sort of knew our procedures and he'd done the work of a line attorney. So he kind of is sympathetic to what goes in and he knows what goes into an opinion and he's very intent on being a good writer. So in terms of getting him up to speed, there wasn't really a lot to worry about. I mean, he'd been part of the court community before, and so it wasn't super rough transition. But I will say Chief Justice McClure, who I love dearly, she's an amazing judge, amazing family law practitioner. When she did retire, having to deal with that transition was a little bumpy, just in terms of trying to manage, okay, we need visiting judges to fill out the third spot because at bigger courts, obviously, you just rotate somebody in. But then, we're, you know, it's trying to figure out, okay, well, who is on deck as our visiting judges? Who can sit on this? Because it's like you said, with a 3-judge court, a lot of the bigger logistical issues that bigger courts don't have to deal with turn into issues with us. But we managed to get through it. It's been fairly smooth. Chief Justice Rodriguez is really pushing us to clear out our backlog. And so we've made some good progress on that. And in a way, the coronavirus slowing things down has really helped us because the number of filings has fallen kind of dramatically, which on one hand is bad, but on the other hand, is good for us at the court because it helps us clear out our inventory.
I think now would be the right time to give a shout out to a friend of the show, Judge Roy Ferguson, who I know is sat as one of your visiting justices and has told us how much he enjoys doing that.
Yeah. He's great. I love Judge Ferguson. He's got the best stories. He's super smart too. I mean, he's always a pleasure to have on our panels.
Well, there were a few other kind of unique issues about the Eighth Court that we thought we might explore. And aside from being in a different time zone from the majority of our state, It is one of the few courts. The Corpus Christi Edinburgh Court is another that is in a border town. And so, I mean, El Paso is more than just a border town, but I assume that being located where it is, that there are some unique issues involving the border and transnational or international matters. Is that accurate?
Definitely. I would agree with that. Our docket tends to be a little bit smaller, and so we may not get a lot of the special appearance issues that you would get out of, you know, Houston and Dallas, but the ones that we do get are fairly interesting. A few years ago, I worked on a case that involved a traffic accident in Mexico, but the tire had been sold in the United States and the suit was brought in El Paso. And so the big question was, okay, tire may or may not have been sold in Texas. Accident happens in Mexico. Do the people who are in the car are El Paso residents? Where does this go to court? And so we'll get things like that. I know that Chief Justice McClure had worked on a divorce case involving a prenup that was signed in Mexico for a couple that was a very prominent couple in Mexico, very wealthy. I believe it was the wife who filed divorce in the United States. And the question was, how do you interpret the prenup? And it involved sort of going through Mexican law, things like that. And she and her husband both know a lot about the Mexican family law system. So that was sort of an interesting case. We've had cases involving injunctions where someone will take documents from a business in Mexico and they here in the United States and they want to try and get them back to Mexico. So it's not happening all the time, but I will say that we do get some kind of juicy international issues. And some of it is just a logistical challenges. You know, we've had cases where it'll be a juvenile defendant who they'll cross back and forth between El Paso and Juarez, and the court will be trying to, I guess, get a hold of them. And even the attorneys aren't able to get a hold of them because it's like, well, we don't know if they've gone back to Mexico. So we do see those. Sometimes we get child abduction cases. So we have a mix of some interesting issues that pop up.
You also cover a lot of really important oil and gas territory too. So I bet you see a lot of those issues as well.
Yeah, I never would have thought that I would have learned as much about oil and gas as I did. I didn't go to law school in Texas. I went to law school in DC. So there's not a lot of oil out in DC. And so I come back and I had to learn oil and gas for the bar. And I was like, none of this makes any sense. Thank God I'll never have to see this again. And then I started working at the 8th Court and we have all kinds of complicated oil and gas leases, cases involving one of the first cases I didn't work on, but it was at the very beginning of sort of my career with the court was some company was releasing carbon dioxide as a byproduct of oil and gas production. And originally no one cared what happened to the CO2. It was just vented out. But then as fracking became more common, all of a sudden that CO2 had value and everyone was scrambling to try and figure out under this contract that was probably written in the 1930s or 1940s, who was entitled to the CO2. And obviously that was not something that had ever been contemplated by the people who signed the lease, because back then you just vented out the gas, but it turned into a big controversy. It was sort of an interesting case, but we do get a lot of oil and gas cases, and it's not always from counties that have a lot of population. Loving County is, I think, the least populated county in Texas, if not the United States. It's in our district, but we do get a fair amount of oil and gas litigation disproportionate to the population, because I think ExxonMobil has pretty big operations out there. And so even though there's not many people living out there, we do get a lot of cases kind of coming from these smaller counties. We call them the down district counties.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
For a number of years, your court was a transferee court from a lot of different courts. Is that still the case?
Yes, that's still the case.
You see probably a little bit of everything coming from some of the other courts of appeals throughout the state.
Yes, that's true. So we'll get transfers from Fort Worth. We've gotten transfers from Austin that are those kind of big, unwieldy administrative law cases that specialized ones for Austin. Then we get them and then we're like, what is this? I've never seen this before. But we do get a little bit of everything. And the transfer cases, I know, have been sort of controversial. I know during the last legislative session, that was one of the issues that had come up during redistricting in terms of trying to figure out, okay, how do we equalize the case numbers among the justices? Because right now, the way that it works is that the Texas Supreme Court tries to make sure that each justice in the state system has relatively equal amounts of cases. And so there's a formula that they use. It's kind of arcane. I'm not even really 100% sure. Sometimes I wonder if it's just like incense and like astrology and in terms of trying to figure out how we equalize these cases. But we do tend to get transfers. Again, the number of transfers went down during COVID. The transfers have sort of started up again. But we're always cognizant of the fact that when we're hearing a transfer case, in a way, we're almost like sitting as a panel of the original transferor court. And the rules of appellate procedure require us to apply the precedent of the transferor court where it would conflict with our own. And so, again, we're always cognizant of that. We're always trying to make sure that we're being faithful to the law of the district from which the cases come.
How do you approach that, though, in an area where maybe the law isn't settled? Maybe the, say you've got a transfer from the third court and the third court hasn't decided the issue. It would be basically an issue of first impression in the third court. Do you fall back on the proverbial law of Texas, which is kind of what I was always taught? You know, there really is only one body of law. There's not 14 bodies, but as we all know, it's most helpful to cite cases when you're appearing in a particular jurisdiction from the Court of Appeals that presides in that jurisdiction. So what do you do in a case of first impression kind of situation, if you can answer?
Yeah, of course. So I think in a case of first impression situation, we just treat it like we would any other case of first impression. If there's guiding case law similar from the transferor district that's pointed to our attention, then we'll sort of apply it and try to analogize it as best as we can. But if it's like a statutory construction issue, then we just treat it like a regular statutory construction issue and say, okay, let's go through plain reading, canons of interpretation, you know, giving effect to all parts of it. And so it really depends on the situation, but if it's an open question, then we treat it like an open question. The good thing is that I want to say 90% of the law is basically the same among the districts, and people may kind of push back on that, but I really think that for the most part, a lot of things are kind of similar enough to where you can make an eerie guess, if you want to call it that, for the other districts. But yeah, we have had situations where we had these two cases, I guess, sort of got separated out and they were administrative cases. And Austin had a group of, it was like an energy company's having to deal with a specific type of equipment and whether there was a tax benefit associated with that. Austin had one group of applicants. We got another group of applicants by accident. And so there did end up being a split where Austin came out before the Eighth Court came out one way on the question of law. And then the majority, the Eighth Court came out a few days later, another way on a question of law, seeing kind of a distinction. And that ended up having to go to the Supreme Court and getting resolved. But I mean, that was one of the cases that was going to be resolved by the Supreme Court anyway. And then if I remember correctly, we had a case, I won't say out of which district, but we had made sort of a quote unquote eerie guess of what they were going to do. And then a couple of years later, that court took up the same issue. And they're like, we recognize that the El Paso court came to this decision, but we've decided that we're not going to agree with it. And so they went another way. And so they created a split with us. But I mean, as far as I know, that never actually went to the Supreme Court. So I still don't know what value that has as precedent, whether we rely on that as precedent, if it's just a errant decision kind of hanging out in the ether. Like it's sort of a weird situation, but I will say those situations are incredibly rare.
That's an appellate lawyer's dream right there, is having an eerie guest from one court sitting in as a transferee court, and then the actual transferor court come out a different way.
Yeah, it's crazy. That. I don't know what the answer to that is. I mean, that's above my pay grade. I mean, that's for the Texas Supreme Court to decide if they ever decide they want to wade into that. I will not speculate.
Yeah. One of my recollections, and I may be wrong about this, was that your court for a long time has sort of embraced video argument as an alternative. So you guys were kind of positioned well at the beginning of the pandemic, because you already, at least in practice, had some familiarity with video arguing.
Yes. When I first started at the court, it's almost been about 8 years. We did have, it's sort of like a giant TV on what looks like a gallows, and it has a camera. And I think it was Cisco equipment. And it, you know, at the time it was super high tech, and it would zoom in on a justice that was asking a question. And so we would use that for some of the transfer cases, to where, you know, people could be in Dallas arguing a case, and we would use the video conference to avoid having them travel out to El Paso. And a lot of people, even those who work in the court system, were unaware that video conferencing has sort of been an option, I think, since at least 2010, if not earlier. Like, that's actually in the government code, that the Chief Justice of each Court of Appeals has the discretion to decide whether they want to hear oral argument by video conference technology. We were one of the only courts, I think 13th Court may have also, because they're kind of a big district, but we were one of the only courts that sort of embraced that, because just for logistical realities. I do remember, it was kind of a funny story. When I first started, they have us, the youngest attorneys are the ones that are required to run the buzzer during oral arguments. And so for the first 2 or 3 years that I was at the court, I was the one who was running the buzzer. And during the transfer cases, they would roll out the giant TV and put it in front of the bench. And one of the first times I saw it, our clerk at the time was trying to turn on the TV, and they kept saying, you know, all right, the Court of Appeals is now in session. Court of Appeals is now in session. And at the other end, I think they were at like the SMU, somewhere in like a courtroom or whatever. And you could hear the crowd going on in the background. And she kept saying, court's in session. And it's like, okay, court's in session. Shut up now. Like, why is there so much noise going on? And then it turned out something was on mute. And of course, once they realized it was on mute, everyone got quiet and the session started. And it was sort of like an aside afterwards of like, well, thank God we don't have to do this every time. And then COVID hits years later. And we're like, oh, well, at least we know how to handle the you're on mute problem.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. Having already been used to video conference oral arguments, I guess that was maybe another way in which the 8th Court was already prepared for dealing with the pandemic. Did you all transition pretty quickly into handling arguments over Zoom, or how did you do it?
Yeah. So the transition out during COVID was fairly quick. I want to say maybe about a week or two ahead of time. Justice Rodriguez is very concerned about the COVID stuff. And we honestly, none of us knew how serious it was going to be, but it was sort of one of those, okay, well, just in case we may need to evacuate the courthouse or whatever, let's kind of come up with a continuity plan. And so we started looking into that. And luckily we had done some preparations in anticipation so that when we did go into lockdown, the court was able to kind of go fully remote. And it was a little scary at first for people, not necessarily because we didn't have the technology, but because it was a new process. But we were able to do that. And Jeff Alley was the Chief Justice at the time, and he adopted Zoom oral arguments fairly quickly. Again, I think we were one of the first courts to do it, because his attitude was sort of like, okay, well, just because we're in a pandemic doesn't mean that the wheels of justice have to stop. So we did start doing oral arguments. And at first, it's weird for everybody involved, right? I mean, one, it's an unusual situation globally going on. But two, there's a lot of challenges that come with losing some of the physical elements of not being in the courtroom. People are used to sort of projecting their voice. And so we'd have a lot of people kind of yelling into the microphone. It's like, no, like, just come down. Like, you don't need to project. We're not 10 feet away. Then the other thing is that now we all know this, but at the beginning, we didn't know it. But on Zoom, the judges' faces are like right in your face. And so when they're seating 6, 10, however many feet away and kind of elevated, you can sort of see their faces, but they're not super close. Whereas on Zoom, every facial tick, every eye roll, every smirk, every whatever is available. And that cuts both ways, because I've heard at CLEs like, oh, you know, counsel, don't roll your eyes when opposing counsel says something because it'll show up on Zoom. But sometimes you have to be the judges, remind them. It's like, no, you're on camera too. So make sure you're like stone-faced and that you don't sort of tip your cards.
Is your court looking to go back to in-person? Or are you going to continue to offer Zoom as an option, or have you decided yet?
So we're still kind of on the fence about that right now. We do have Zoom sessions scheduled, and then we do have court staff kind of doing a mixed remote and on-site situation where some people are going to the office, some people are still working remote. And we do have some permanent staff that we've hired, and temporary staff attorneys that are fully remote that don't live in El Paso. We've hired outside of El Paso. So that's been good for us because sometimes it's difficult to attract people to come to El Paso if they're not from here, which, you know, I mean, I love El Paso and we've had some great personnel come out to El Paso, but usually they'll stay for a year or two and they kind of treat it like a federal clerkship where it's like, you know, you're here for 2 years and then you're gone. For us, being able to hire people out in Lubbock or Houston or the Austin area has just been great for us. But in terms of oral argument, we're still up in the air. Obviously, we'd like to go back to doing oral argument in person at some point, but I know that Chief Justice Rodriguez does want to retain the teleconferencing as an option. And to be honest, I think some attorneys also want to retain that as an option. You know, at first, there was a lot of resistance to teleconference arguments, but once we got past the jitters, some people are like, oh, well, this actually works out fairly well. And it's a lot better than like the United States Supreme Court where they're trying to do the, I don't know if you guys have listened in, but it's like round robin. It's like the worst conference call ever where it's, you know, everyone gets 30 seconds and like nothing gets decided on. Whereas Zoom is actually a pretty good balance, I would say.
Sure. Now, the El Paso court, in my recollection, has occasionally sat in other locations. I recall specifically, I believe it was Midland. That was going on pre-COVID times. Is that something the court was regularly doing before the pandemic? And I guess maybe we could see that happen again afterward.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're allowed under statute to sit in any one of the 17 counties over which we have jurisdiction. So occasionally, I want to say maybe we would do it once a year, once every 18 months, we would go to Alpine or Marfa and Judge Ferguson would host us out there in his courtrooms. The one in Alpine is a little small, but the one in Marfa is sort of like To Kill a Mockingbird where they redid it and they have the railings up at top. And so it's kind of fun to go out and do that. The judges do have to kind of make accommodations in terms of how they sit because obviously, you know, the Court of Appeals, they have a bench and it's three judges. And so it's like, okay, you're in a trial court. The chief judge, I guess, is sitting where the trial judge would sit. And then someone's got to sit in the witness box and someone's got to sit over where the court reporter would sit. And so, you know, there's some logistical challenges, but it's kind of nice. And it's sort of like you get to see all these different courtrooms. You get to be out kind of in the middle of the desert, going from a big city, like 650,000 people to a smaller town and getting a real feel for some of these places where we're deciding cases, but we don't really know much about it. It's nice. And of course, like I said, Judge Ferguson is great. He always shows us great hospitality. And yeah, it's a good opportunity. We do like to travel. And that's one of the things that I hope we get to do again real soon.
Well, I wanted to take advantage of the fact that we've got an expert in mandamuses and motions for emergency relief, which we covered to some degree earlier, but we were chatting, I believe, before we started recording that we'd like to talk more about original proceedings on this show. We tend to talk about, you know, general concepts of advocacy, oral argument, briefing, and so forth. But have y'all seen like an uptick in mandamus filings in relation to, say, ordinary appeal filings during the pandemic? I mean, how has that come about?
So I would say that our mandamus filings are probably normal. I wouldn't say there had been a spike. I had sort of expected there to be a spike based on people challenging the emergency orders or trying to force a trial or things like that. But I was kind of surprised. And I actually did a CLE for the Appellate Section's Diversity Committee where I kind of went through the mandamus filings and thought, okay, they would spike up. But really, for the most part, people kind of accepted the emergency orders and haven't really brought a lot of challenges to those necessarily, except a little bit more recently. But for the most part, our mandamus filings kind of stayed steady.
Do you have any, and we'll ask you for tips or a war story before we stop recording, but I'm just thinking about if there's anyone who's in a position to talk about the differences between mandamus and ordinary appeal, like Kirk, I think you're the guy.
Yeah.
Just can you run through a couple of the major differences? I mean, we know what the standards are generally, abuse of discretion for which there's no adequate remedy at law. But in terms of, let's say, advocacy, how you present the arguments in written form, how you present the arguments, maybe even at oral argument, if you all have oral argument on mandamuses, that's pretty rare in the third court, I know. What would you say would be the big differences to think about as advocates?
So I think the big thing to watch out for in original proceedings is sort of not necessarily the first prong of the abuse of discretion, but the second prong of adequate remedies by appeal, because that's sort of where all the litigation has happened. And after the Prudential case, it's sort of gone, I don't want to say wide open, but it's a lot more subjective. There's a lot more different factors. So the big thing is sort of going in and explaining why there's no remedy by appeal, or why whatever remedy by appeal you have is inadequate. So I think that's sort of number one, because a lot of the mandamuses will get kicked out because somebody will try to, I'll give you an example, and this has been a recurring issue and it's not totally settled, but when the trial court grants or denies a motion for temporary injunction, right, there's a right to interlocutory appeal from that. So sometimes we'll get mandamuses filed where they're trying to challenge the temporary injunction, but there's a right to interlocutory appeal. And so that's been a recurring issue of, okay, if you can challenge this by interlocutory appeal, that kind of suggests that you have an adequate remedy. So why is it that you weren't able to take that appeal timely? Like, you have to explain the extraordinary circumstances, because otherwise that's just going to be an automatic knockout. I see that as step one. If it's reversed, but for me, that's step one, is there an adequate remedy by appeal? So that would be the first one. In terms of oral arguments, we had a weird spate of criminal discovery cases that came up, which is unusual because there's not really a lot of criminal discovery going on, but Code of Criminal Procedure does allow for limited discovery. So we did have kind of a group of those come up on when you can, for example, one case was, I think it was a sexual assault case, and the defense was trying to use a criminal subpoena to get access to the victim's cell phone. And under the rules of civil procedure, there's a lot of details on when you can get access to third-party materials. There's not as much in the Code of Criminal Procedure. So we did select those for oral argument. So we do get some of those. And then in terms of advocacy, again, I would just go back to remember the logistical concerns of the court. If you're looking for a decision by a certain time, like, for example, like I was talking about earlier, like you have a discovery issue, you're trying to see if there's privilege or not, you're running up against a statute of limitations, you really need a decision by the end of the week. Or we had a case that involved a closing of a house. And it's like, okay, the closing date is on Friday. Today is Monday. Make that clear in your petition. If you really want to cover all your bases and be safe, you can even file a motion for expedited consideration or something like that. But at the very least, communicate that to the court and say, we're looking for a decision by X date, because otherwise it may end up getting kind of lost in the fray.
I guess for a mandamus with a request for emergency relief, I mean, oral argument is, as a practical matter, probably off the table. You're not going to have the time.
Right. I mean, theoretically, it can happen, but usually there's not enough time to do that.
So the lesson there is put your best foot forward in your mandamus petition and in your motion, you know, make it clear to the court what it is you want the court to do and why it's important enough to grant emergency relief on top of any potential relief on the actual writ.
Right. And then I would say on the portion dealing with emergency relief, it's sort of a weird situation because that's like the shadow docket, right? It's like the U.S. Supreme Court shadow docket where you have all these ancillary orders that come out and they're not really case law, but they're kind of case law. And you can sort of interpret what the court is saying or kind of trying to read the tea leaves. And so there's not a lot of case law specifically interpreting the rule that deals with emergency relief for original proceedings. But I will say that recently there's been some stuff that's come out from the Texas Supreme Court that has kind of touched on that issue. And sometimes we are in the position where we're having to deal with very complicated motions on the emergency relief itself. You know, I'm thinking of recently the court faced, and this was a COVID issue, where El Paso County had issued a stay-at-home order and the governor had issued a superseding open up. And so that resulted in temporary injunction litigation that was going on that came to us. That was an interlocutory appeal, but it's sort of the same thing where we have an emergency motion in the meantime to grant an injunction that the trial court had denied. And so there was a lot of briefing kind of on that specific point alone. And then the court did end up issuing kind of, I don't want to say opinions, but there were orders that were more detailed than what you would normally get, the two granted or denied. And I believe there was even like a dissent. So that's to say that don't necessarily just look at the opinions. Sometimes these orders on the shadow docket can have little nuggets of information that may prove to be useful. And unfortunately, those don't always get picked up by Westlaw.
Oh, well, that's absolutely right. I think of temporary injunctions as being emergency orders on TIs being a rich area for that sort of thing. Another one that comes to mind is motions to review supersedious orders, because it's the same sort of deal. And those actually can generate mandamuses, particularly in the Supreme Court. But I will tell you, having seen some of that myself about these orders not being available on Westlaw, it's a little frustrating when you know the court has decided an issue and you don't have anything good to cite to.
Right. But they're extremely difficult to find if you're not on Westlaw and you have to go through the Texas Supreme Court search where you're trying to go through the documents and you're trying to find like injunction, and you have all these stuff pop up from Thames, and it's really not easy to do. And there hasn't been as much interest in the shadow docket at the state level as there has been at the U.S. Supreme Court level. I mean, I read SCOTUS blog every morning, and I know that there's all kinds of law professors that are trying to interpret even the little standard two line, oh, this motion is denied thing. And they're like, what does it mean? Who's voting this way? Who's that way? And so there's a large body of speculation from these professors, and they've picked up on important things. Like again, with the COVID stuff, a lot of important decisions have been made on these interim orders by the Supreme Court. And so you're kind of having to interpret these orders that may or may not have precedent. You don't even know, because they're really interlocutory. And so that's problem one. And problem two is that if you can't find these, how useful are they? I really think that that would be a good area of focus for someone who is interested in, I don't know, writing an article or something like that, is kind of on the shadow dockets and how they work for the state of Texas.
That's a great topic.
I think Pam Barron talks about the shadow docket sometimes in her CLE presentations. And I believe Don Cruz might also.
At the Texas Supreme Court, yeah.
Yeah, you don't really think about it in the intermediate courts that much, but these are some great examples that we've talked about ways that can happen in important areas that affect the litigants directly. And from the lawyer perspective, we want to be able to cite precedent to the court. Well, you agreed that this is what Rule Trap 24.2 meant in this case, but that so rarely comes up because that's, as you say, an ancillary issue to the actual meat of the appeal, the merits.
Right. And then, you know, another thing just kind of quickly on the differences is that the differences between, let's say you have an ordinary appeal and then you have an interlocutory appeal and then you have an original proceeding. The interlocutory appeals and the original proceedings have rules that specifically allow for emergency relief to happen. Whereas in an ordinary appeal, there's not really a mechanism in the rules to let you get this sort of emergency relief. Like the scope of relief that can be granted on an ordinary appeal, the way I understand it, is more limited because there's not a rule specifically authorizing it. And so you kind of have to fall back on the court's inherent injunction powers. But even then, the Court of Appeals only has the power to issue an injunction that would go to protect its own jurisdiction. So in the example I gave of the building coming down, the reason that the court is able to issue an injunction there is because it would moot the subject matter of the appeal. So there's more leeway in an interlocutory appeal and an original proceeding, which is, I think, is why a lot of people file original proceedings that may not really go anywhere, is because they want to get the foot in the door to get a stay, knowing that the mandamus is going to fail on the merits, which gets annoying for me because I'm like, okay, I see what you're doing. But there is sort of an undefined, I don't want to say emergency power, but the powers for interlocutory appeal and original proceedings aren't as clearly defined. And there's even an open question as to whether they necessarily follow the standards of an injunction in the trial court and whether that is sort of the framework you use, whether it's broader. Because, you know, really, I don't remember the specific language, but it says something like whatever necessary order. Well, okay, does that mean you have to follow the injunction standard or you don't have to follow the injunction standard? There's a lot of open questions. So it's sort of a ripe area for litigation. And fortunately for me, because I don't want to have to write all these 5-page orders, but unfortunately, there's not a lot of clarity on it.
Yeah, the Supreme Court handed y'all some interesting issues with that GeoMet case and what you have to do with temporary orders that I think are still not very well fleshed out.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that.
One thing that's worth mentioning before we move on from mandamus is that I think a lot of trial lawyers overlook sometimes is they're so focused on, well, we got a really bad outcome, we really need to get this stayed. They forget that the only way to get temporary or emergency relief in the Court of Appeals is by filing your motion at least concurrently, if not after you file your mandamus petition. And that is one instance in appellate practice where I think it most closely resembles trial practice in terms of the timelines. And if you're dealing with a true emergency, like, for example, the building that's going to be knocked down, I mean, that's you're right in there with temporary injunctions and TROs in terms of the level of intensity to operate with, because I've just seen so many instances in which you really have got to get a mandamus petition on file quickly. And so it's always interesting to me when and it hasn't happened very often, but when trial lawyers will ask, or worse yet, take action, like file an emergency motion without a mandamus petition. And I can tell you right now exactly what the order is going to say, you know, or at least the thought process that the court's going through is it's, you know, can't grant you any relief without a mandamus petition on file.
Right. And people don't understand that. And it's funny you mentioned that, because that happened recently a few weeks ago where somebody, again, front desk lets me know there's an emergency motion has come in, and I'm like, okay, well, what case is it? And they're like, well, there's no case for it. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they're like, they just filed a motion. And I was like, well, have they filed the mandamus petition? And they're like, well, they said that they're going to. And I was like, okay, tell them that they can file this motion once they filed the mandamus petition, because we don't even have a case number open yet. I don't know what's going on. And I understand, and I'm sympathetic, because when there's a fast moving situation like that, and you say you have to file the mandamus petition before you file the emergency motion, right? You're there trying to type something out, and you may not be able to get everything you want in that original mandamus petition, but your goal is to get that stay, right? So it's sort of a balancing act of how much you put in there, how bad you want the stay, and you're willing to risk asking the court to let you amend the mandamus petition later to include things that you may have forgotten, because the court doesn't necessarily need to allow for an amended mandamus as far as I'm aware. I think that's still a discretionary issue, but maybe not.
I think it probably is, but having looked at that issue before, I don't see anything in the rule that prohibits an amended mandamus petition. As long as you're seeking review of the same order, I think you could amend. What I've seen come up that's even more problematic is if the order's in the trial court amended and you've got a mandamus petition on file, then what? Is it an amended petition, or do you just refile with a new mandamus petition to attack that new order? My sense of it is it's a different order. You need to file a new mandamus or amend to make clear that you're applying your petition to the new order.
Right. I would agree with that. And it's sort of hard to know, because it really depends on, you have to look at the order, you have to look at the new order and sort of how they interact. But it's always a good idea, out of an abundance of caution, to do exactly what you said. It's either file a new mandamus or file an amended motion saying, okay, something's happened in the trial court. And so this is sort of the thing. And then the other thing you have to worry about is, does this moot your entire petition? If the order's changed, then all of a sudden it's moot and you're like, okay, well, and it may be good for you because that was what you were ultimately seeking. But yeah, it does get complicated fairly quickly. And it's not something people tend to think a lot about until they're in the midst of it. And then they're trying to learn how all this emergency stuff works on the fly.
Important footnote there. If that does happen and your petition is mooted, please tell the court.
Yes. Please, yeah. Tell us. Yes. We're trying to clear things out. And so we don't want things hanging out on the docket. And I really don't want there to be a situation where it's like, okay, we've worked this up. And then all of a sudden they're like, oops, sorry, this was moot 2 weeks ago and I've wasted 2 weeks of my time.
Yep. Here's your advisory opinion.
Yeah.
Well, and in our last few minutes, as we're closing up, one thing we wanted to touch on that we've talked about with some other guests is diversity. And I know you're a part of the Appellate Section Diversity Committee. Can you tell us a little bit about that committee and kind of what you guys do and that type of thing?
Sure. So the Appellate Section Diversity Committee, our goal is to try and increase the number of women, people of color, LGBTQ attorneys that are arguing kind of at the appellate level here at the state and nationwide. And diversity is such a big, huge issue, and there's so many moving parts to it. It used to be that we would take CLE to parts of the state that may not have a lot of appellate lawyers. So the El Paso area, the Valley area, and then try to sort of use that as the diversity component. This past year, we continued doing CLEs, but because of COVID, they've gone online. And actually, we've seen our attendance go up. But it's really kind of a challenge to do diversity initiatives in appellate law, just because, one, it's such a niche area of law that not a lot of people are interested in to begin with. First of all, I mean, you have to have the personality type to, like we said earlier, sit in front of a computer all day and absorb, and you have to kind of be like a legal nerd. But even separate and apart from that, there's still a lot of issues where, for many appellate lawyers, there's a pipeline where it really starts your first or second year of law school of, did you get the grades to get on law review? And then if you got on law review, did you get in with the right firm? Or did you get in with the right clerkship? And then if you have the right clerkship at the district court level, did you get a federal courtship level? And then it goes to another firm. So there's a pipeline where if you're not at the right moment doing what you need to be doing, you could potentially be excluded from the field entirely, when really there's a lot of people like myself. I wasn't necessarily the best law student in terms of test taking or whatever, but where I did excel was in all my appellate and writing classes, where you give me a case, I can sit down, I can research it myself and come back with something. And that was where they're like, well, we don't understand. Like, you're way up here on appellate stuff, but on the test, you're just doing okay. And it's because there's a lot of different skill sets and issues that I don't think that pipeline we've talked about necessarily captures. And so if you're not within that pipeline, regardless of whether you are quote unquote diverse or not, it can be hard to break into appellate law.
Absolutely. We've had a lot of conversations. In fact, we had Juveria Khan from the Appellate Project on to talk about that. Or if you don't even know about the pipeline or that it exists until it's too late to be part of it, it really does erect some barriers that don't need to be there.
Right. And I can say that I've been very lucky, because when I going to graduate from law school, I did the federal clerkship process and I applied to district clerkships all across the country, didn't get anything. There were some state clerkships in South Florida that had showed some interest because I'm bilingual, but that didn't really pan out anyway. And so I got very, very lucky in that I was able to come back to El Paso, my hometown, and work for the Court of Appeals there and be able to go from someone who wasn't necessarily inside that pipeline and someone who's living in El Paso, which I love El Paso, but we're in the middle of the desert. We're like 500 miles from everywhere else. We're in a totally different time zone. And I came from a law school outside of Texas, so I didn't have those sort of connections, which made it even more difficult. And I was lucky enough to get this job to where now I'm able to do appellate law, which I love. I was able to get board certified, serve on all these committees and stuff like that. But I was not the traditional student that would have been caught up in that pipeline. And so if I had not had this opportunity, I don't know that I would be doing appellate law right now.
Well, Kirk, you've been very gracious with your time. We've gone a little longer than we anticipated going, but I enjoyed hearing your insights and your stories. And the discussion of original proceedings and emergency motions particularly, I think, is very useful and something that practitioners...
Well, before we go, Kirk, we always like to ask our guests for a tip or a war story. Do you have something you can share with us on that?
Sure. So I know we've run a little bit long, so I'll try to keep this short, but... And I don't know if this constitutes a war story necessarily or not, but when I was going to law school, I went to law school in DC. One of the advantages of that is that the Supreme Court is right down the road. And so our professor's first year had a policy where it was like, never skip my class ever for any reason. But if you skip to go watch a Supreme Court argument, we may look the other way. So my first year of law school, there was this big First Amendment case called Snyder versus Phelps involving the Westboro Baptist Church. I don't know if you guys remember, they're the ones who are holding up signs out in front of the military funerals saying, you know, thank God for dead soldiers, and a lot of really ugly, a lot of really homophobic stuff. And so the question was whether they could be sued for intentional infliction of emotional distress or whether they had a First Amendment defense to suit. So our church professor reminded us of the policy and was like, you can't miss class, but if you were to go see Snyder versus Phelps, let me know how it goes. So at 8 o'clock the day before at night, my friend Josh calls and says, you need to get to the Supreme Court right now. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, we've camped out because we were trying to get tickets to get in the next morning, but you need to get here immediately because there's already a line. And so get here now. And I was like, well, I don't have like a tent or blanket or whatever. He's like, no, 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 just get here. Whatever you're wearing, just get here. So I show up. It's like October at night, like 40 degrees. And so we're camped out in front of the Supreme Court. It was a good little bonding experience because it was a horrible night because it was cold. The sprinklers at the Supreme Court lawn went off at like 3 a.m. So no sleep. We're soaking wet. And then finally they line us up in the morning and they say the first 50 people are going to get floor seats because everyone and their grandma in the Supreme Court bar has called in their tickets. So we don't have as many seats. So the first 50 people get to sit for the whole time. The rest of you have to cycle in and out of the gallery. So I ended up being person number 52. So half my classmates got to go in and I end up my first time being in the US Supreme Court, sitting up in a visitor gallery. They sit me down behind a pillar so I can't see anything. And so in the middle of argument and I'm trying to lean over to the side to see what's going on and they're asking questions. And I was really excited to be there, but I was 22. I was in street clothes and tennis shoes. I was soaking wet and dirty and delirious. And then finally, after about 5 minutes, they're like, okay, Supreme Court police is like, get up, you got to go. And I was like, well, no, like they're doing the rest of the argument. They're like, no, get up. We got to get the next group of people to like cycle in. So it was kind of funny, but I tend to think about that a lot of having gone from someone who was a kid who knew absolutely nothing about appeals and showed up to the Supreme Court in absolutely the wrong clothing, absolutely like the wrong mindset, dirty, cold, wet. And it's just been a crazy journey now that I get to actually be an appellate lawyer. So hopefully one day I'll get to be in the Supreme Court, you know, appropriately dressed, doing argument as opposed to like being sleep deprived and probably smelling like wet dog.
That's a great story. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, definitely.
It really is. We'll appreciate hearing about, but we're just glad to have you as a guest and thank you for spending the time with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.